listening to Shop Talk with your host, Kevin Tates. Brought to you by Eastwood Tools. Everything you need to do the job right.
Hey, Gearheads, I'm your host, Kevin Tates, and this is Shop Talk, brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Do the job right with Eastwood. Well, this conversation is, well, it's kind of special to me. If you guys know me at all, you know I kind of gravitate towards Fords. I love them all, don't get me wrong, but I always seem to end up with a Ford project. And to put a finer point on it, there's always been something about the Mustang that focuses my attention. Mustangs are in my dreams, and my little 66 coupe, Project Jaded, is an example of my sickness. I've been writing for Mustang magazines for the better part of the past 10 years off and on, and to have the opportunity to talk with the editor of what is considered the benchmark Mustang publication, yes, we're talking about Mustang Monthly, is a real treat. Donald Farr has not only been in the editor's chair for many years, he's been writing about Mustangs in one form or another for 30-odd years. He's authored and co-authored books including How to Restore Your Mustang, Mustang Boss 302, as well as the new release Mustang 50 Years. So it's an understatement to say that he's an authority on all things Mustang. We get to talk about his roots, his first Mustang, as well as Donald remembering some moments he shared with the legendary Carroll Shelby. We also touched on what's coming at us with the all-new Mustang, set to be released within the 2014 model year in conjunction with the Mustang's 50th anniversary that's coming up. So hang out and take a listen. You are listening to Shop Talk, brought to you by the Eastwood Company. Do the job right with Eastwood. Now, whether you're a Mustang freak like I am or just plain into the cars that have lived under that name for the past almost 50 years, you've probably heard the name Donald Farr at some point. Donald is currently the editor of Mustang Monthly magazine, and if anybody has ever been dyed-in-the-wool or baptized Mustang, it's Donald Farr. So, Donald, it's a pleasure to have you with us, man. Thanks for spending some time.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks to you, Kevin.
Well, there's a couple of things that, you know, do my little bit of research, I have learned about you that I didn't already know. You and I, we kind of go back a ways, and I knew this one. I knew that you were inducted into the Mustang Hall of Fame. Tell me and some of the listeners about that.
Well, that was a great honor, obviously. You know, if you go to the Mustang Club of America website and go to their Hall of Fame, and you see names like Lee Iacocca and Carroll Shelby and Joe Orris, who was one of the designers, and then my name's in there too. Well, that's just a tremendous honor. As I've told a lot of people, I didn't build any Mustangs and I didn't design any Mustangs. All I did was write about them, and I've had a great time doing that for the past 33 years, I think, something like that.
Yeah. Well, congratulations with
Thank
that,
you.
Man. It's got to feel pretty good to be associated with the top of the heap like that, man.
Yeah, it does feel good. It's nice to have people think of me that way, and you know, after all these years, I guess I put a lot of effort and blood, sweat, and tears and time away from the wife and family back in the past 20 years. So it's nice to be recognized, certainly.
Well, it's a passion, and obviously you have that. The rest of us do, and certainly technique to it as well. But I want to go back a little bit. When did you first realize that you were bitten not only by the Mustang bug, but by the gearhead disease? When did you first know you were a car guy?
Well, I guess I was probably 12 or 13. That would have been in the mid-60s. I really remember loving the 66 cars. And it mm-hmm. wasn't particularly Mustangs at that time, but there were cool cars for 66. The Dodge Charger and the Corvette Stingray.
Oldsmobile
Toronado. I loved Hideaway Headlights and Fastbacks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of when, and I started buying plastic models and putting them together and that sort of thing. So I don't know that I knew that I was a car guy, but I knew I liked cars.
Now, we've all had a first car. We all learned to drive something. But what was your first Mustang?
It would have been, my senior year of high school, 1970, September 1970. My parents had decided they were tired of me driving their car to, on Saturday nights and any time during the week. I played in high school band, so there was high school band practice. I played in rock and roll band, so there was band practices there. And And there were, of course, dates, girlfriends, and all that. So I think my dad finally got tired of not having a car to drive, and he said, well, we're going to get you a car. You're a senior in high school. And so we went around. We lived in a little town called Union, South Carolina. And I remember we drove to the big city of Spartanburg to check out used cars because he was very practical. He didn't want to spend a lot of money on me, I guess. But also, the other side of that practicality was the fact that he always thought of used cars as somebody else's problem. So, so we looked at used cars. I remember we looked at a Camaro, which I thought was cool because it was a 3-speed on the floor. And we looked at a Capri. And so anyway, we ended up back in the little town of Union at the Ford dealership. And the 71s were already out in September of 1970. So we kind of avoided them because he knew they were more expensive. So we went right to the back lot where they had the leftover 70s, and there were two 70 Mustang Fastbacks back there. One was a grabber, green grabber, and the other was just a pale yellow Mustang with this little stripe on it. And I didn't like the grabber green.
Right.
I didn't get the grabber, and so we went for the little pale yellow 70 Fastback, which turned out just to be a plain Jane little Fastback, 302 two-barrel automatic, but the dealership had dressed it up with a stripe that Ford had made available, and it was almost like a 70 Boss 302 stripe, except it started on the door and didn't go all the way down. It just went halfway down the door and back and had 302 in it. And so that was my first car.
Well, that sounds an awful lot like the Boss 302 stripes. And you know what I've learned about Mustangs and a lot of other cars is that the dealers were very creative when it came to dealer available trim packages, striping packages, and stuff like that. And sometimes that creates a little bit of confusion with collectors and guys that think they've found one of one, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And in fact, years and years later, being involved with Mustang Monthly, I did learn that Ford offered these stripe packages to dealers to dress up plain Fastbacks. They had so much success in 69 with the new Fastback. They sold 72,000 Mach 1s alone, that they had kind of loaded up dealers with all these Fastbacks. And when dealers couldn't sell them, they were looking for ways to dress them up. And they came up with a stripe kit. One was the one that I had, and the other was one on the side, which was more like the Twister specials, but there were two different stripe kits that Ford offered. So anyway, this my car ended up with that stripe, and I remember the first day I drove it to school, a friend of mine came up to me and said, is that a Boss 302? And I didn't even know what a Boss 302 was at the time, but I did some research, and over a period of time I learned, well, the Boss 302 was really the car that you wanted. And
yep.
I always had in the back of my mind, one of these days I'm going to get me a Boss 302.
And you did.
I did.
And you did, and you became the expert or the quintessential authority on Boss 302. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, but since that's such a wonderful segue into that, tell me about the first Boss 302 book.
Well, I'll back up a little bit to say that little yellow Fastback that I had, I drove it about 3.5-4 years. Popped it up with muscle parts Ford and all that. And then one day my wife and I were driving to her aunt in Spartanburg and drove by used car lot, and I saw the nose of a grabber blue 70 Mustang sticking out on this used car lot. And as we drove by, I saw it was a Boss 302. And so I dropped my wife off at her aunt's house, and I turned right around and came back. And it was a Sunday, but I did get a chance to look at the car and it just weighed on my mind. You know, that's all I thought about over the next several days until I could get back up to Spartanburg to talk to the owner of the dealership. And
by this time, you knew what a Boss 302 was.
Well, I knew what a Boss 302 was, yeah. And you know, I wanted this car. So, I mean, you didn't see many. Ford only built 7,000 in 70, so you hardly ever saw them. But here was one for sale. And, we worked out a deal. He took my little 70 Fastback with 100,000 miles on it and $400, and I drove out of there in a Boss 302.
You got to be kidding me.
Yeah, that's all it took back in those days. So,
wow.
That was gas crunch and gas lines, and so people were getting rid of those kind of cars and didn't want them. So I think it was, I think they wanted $1,600 for it. It's a 50,000 mile car. But
wow. Man, you know, I mean, if Mustangs especially, but all these cars that you and I grew up with, if we knew, if we had a time machine, if we could like go into the Star Trek gallery of beam me up, Scotty, and mothball some of these cars, the old Corvettes and some of the Mopar stuff, that's just the prices are inobtainium now. The Shelby cars, man, wouldn't that be something if we could go back in time and heck, you and I could retire.
Yeah, I was back there. I was looking at classified ads in the Shelby American Automobile Club magazine, and Hemmings Motor News was big back in those days. And I was looking at those ads, and there would be a 65 Shelby for $2,800, and
gosh,
I didn't have it.
Yeah.
You know, I was 22, 23 years old, and, you know, working and wife and kids on the way. And, you know, you couldn't afford it. I couldn't afford it then. I can't afford it now. So. It's the way it seems to work.
Well, I guess it's all relative. Well, listen, one of the things that I talk to people about with Shop Talk is we've all been mentored by people. And I'm not sure if you would consider your relationship with Larry Dobbs a mentorship, but I know that you think a lot of him, and he was instrumental in kind of maybe joining your passion into a vocation. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Larry Dobbs and how Mustang Monthly started.
Yeah, well, Larry started Mustang Monthly in 1978 down here in Lakeland, Florida. At the same time, that Grabber Blue Boss 302 that I had bought on the used car lot had kind of blossomed into a bit of a hobby for me. I had gotten involved with the Shelby American Automobile Club. Was doing some writing and photography for them on the side, and I subscribed to Mustang Monthly just right away as soon as I heard about it. I think my first issue was the third issue that Larry put out, and then he announced that he was going to go full size, because early on it was like a tabloid on newsprint, and then he announced that it was going to go full size with color, and he was looking for contributors to supply articles, especially event coverage and that sort of thing. And,
yeah.
And so I had been doing that for the Shelby Club for SAC, and so I wrote him a letter and said, I'm available. You know, I can help you out with some things here. And he wrote me, and that was in the days before email, you know, and it was too expensive.
Right.
It was too expensive to make a long-distance phone call, you know. But,
yeah.
Yeah. So we were trading letters back and forth, and so that first color issue, that was October 1979, I believe. I had my photos were in there covering the SAC convention, which I believe was the one in Downingtown, Pennsylvania, SAC 5, and the Mustang Club of America Grand National down in Atlanta. So I had photos and two stories in there. So. Yeah, that kind of got me hooked, and I think Larry liked what I was doing, and he was still in startup mode, so he couldn't afford to hire somebody experienced or with education or all that, and I hadn't either. So, probably less than a year later, he called me, I believe it was the winter of 79, and asked if I would be interested in coming down and being editor of the magazine, because in addition to the magazine, he had a company called Mustang Supply Company, which sold reproduction decals, owner's manuals, and that sort of thing. So he was
right.
Trying to run both of them, and it was getting a little too much for him. So, he hired me, and we moved. We had to wait a little bit till our son Matthew was born, and then we moved down in August 1980.
Well, let me be forward and ask you what you were doing for a living when that all took place, when you made this transition.
Yeah, I was working at my father's feed store in the little town of Union, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
So, it really wasn't my calling. I weighed about 110 pounds wet, and I was out there hauling around 100-pound sacks of fertilizer. So.
Yeah.
It was long hours, and it really wasn't my thing. So, you know, the car thing, especially the Mustang thing, and photography and writing was what I did at night.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when a door opens, you just got to walk through it, and it sounds like that's precisely what you did.
Yeah, I was very lucky in that way. I didn't make a conscious decision to do this, to do what I'm doing today. It was like, yeah, like you said, those doors just kind of opened along the way. A letter in Popular Hot Rodding led me to a guy in North Carolina who had a Boss 302 club, and that led me. He led me to a guy, his name was Danny Rocket, and he led me to the Shelby American Automobile Club. And the Shelby Automobile Club, through Austin Craig, who was president, encouraged me to write, led me to doing what I was doing when Larry Dobbs called. So, yeah, all of those things were connected, but I wasn't consciously trying. I just did it because I enjoyed it.
Interesting. Well, I have a saying. I didn't coin this, but I subscribe to it and repeat it whenever applicable. Luck is a mathematical equation, and it's where opportunity meets preparedness. And you know, you obviously had a background with and I think the biggest thing is the want and the desire to do it.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
well done. And
I would say it was a passion at the time.
Mm-hmm. So in your tenure, Donald, you have, and by the way, people listening, we're talking with Donald Farr, Mustang expert, author of many publications, editor of Mustang Monthly, and I'm proud to say a friend of mine as well. I wanted to also ask you about music, because you and I share that as well. I played in bands for years, and I tried fruitlessly to become a rock star, and it just never panned out for me. But the car thing was always in my mind and in the background. And you're a bass player, and you're in a blues band, and we almost had a band together at one point. When did you start playing music?
Oh, my mom had me playing, taking piano lessons in first grade.
Good
but,
for her.
Yeah, but I, you know, small school. I didn't learn a lot, but then. In February 1964, these guys named the Beatles showed up on Ed Sullivan, and so I said, I want to swap piano lessons for guitar lessons, and my parents were kind enough to get me a guitar, and I just started taking guitar lessons, and from there, I got hooked up with some guys in town, and then I realized that I was kind of picking out bass lines, so I became a bass player in high school, and that kind of stopped when I got my Mustang. All of a sudden, the Mustang took precedence over playing music, you know?
I understand this.
Yeah, so it went in that direction. Later on, I sold a 68 Precision bass to buy a 351 Cleveland for a Mustang. So, wish I still had that bass.
Yeah, I wish you had that bass, too. That's a sought-after sucker right there.
Yeah, so I took about a 30-year break, and it wasn't until maybe 10 or 12 years ago that my son started playing guitar, and I said, you know, I'd probably like to start doing this again. So I picked it back up and was lucky enough to hook up with some good people here in town and start playing in some bands again, and I really enjoy it.
Well, on that note, I want to tell people we had for the 40th anniversary of the Mustang.
Yes, it was in Nashville.
In Nashville at the Speedway. It was me, Donald, Alan Shepley, I think Jeff Ford was a part of it. There was another fellow that played guitar. His name escapes me, but we had what we were going to do is jump on stage and jam a couple of songs, Mustang Sally and some other you know, automotive specific songs. It was an almost thing, and we called the band, didn't we call it Stang Bangers or something like that?
I don't even remember the name.
Something grossly inappropriate like that.
I remember we had a great rehearsal up around Atlanta, and I can't remember the other guy's name. I remember. He owned.
It was Dave, I think. He had a beautiful Boss 302, didn't he?
He had one of the. He had a special paint silver Boss 302, and I have to wonder. You know, I haven't talked to him in a while. I have to wonder if he still has that car. But that was a cool little band.
Well, I wanted to propose to you that we maybe for the 50th, maybe we you know, a la Spinal Tap, get the band together again. What do you think?
Well, you know. Something could be working because for the Mustang Club of America Grand National show here in Orlando at Disney on Labor Day, they asked if I could put together a band.
Really?
Yeah. So do you know Kyle Caraway from Shelby Fest? Great guitar player. I've sat in with his band at Shelby Fest. So he's going to be the guitar player and vocals. Rick Smith. From President of National Parks Depot is our drummer.
I know Rick well.
Yeah, he's our drummer.
No way. That's awesome.
And if you can find a way to come down here you're welcome to play in our band.
Well, you can email me the dates, and I've been talked out of retirement myself, and my producer on the truck show, his wife is a lead singer in a band, and about 2 years ago, they talked me into playing, and I've graduated from a guitar owner to a guitar player over the last couple of years.
Okay.
We have a blast, man. It's some 80s rock stuff and some R&B and some funk and blues, and just it's just a lot of fun. So, man, I would love to make that happen. You need to email me some
I will do that. Yep.
Very cool. Well, okay, well, that's a bit of a diversion off on the music tangent, but I don't know. I think that there is this inherent thing between rock and roll and hot rods, and I think it goes way deeper than just listening to music. I think the subcultures of both of those are coincidental somehow. What do you think?
Well, I guess so. You know, when I think about you're in the car, you're almost always have music on.
Yeah.
Usually some kind of driving music.
Well, and there's so many songs about cars, and I don't know. I
think maybe you're thinking deeper than me, Kevin. That's.
Let's talk about some of the other books that you've authored. The one that I have had for a long time, and I had to look at the inside pages, is the Mustang Recognition Guide. That book has really served me well. So tell our listeners about the Mustang Recognition Guide and maybe some of the other books that you've been a part of.
Well, when I first came to Mustang Monthly, I remember my first month on the job. We worked on the magazine, and then all of a sudden Larry Dobbs had made the decision that we were going to do a book called How to Restore Your Mustang. So nobody told me that restoring a Mustang was part of the job description, but it became that. And we restored a 65 or 66 Fastback, and I took the pictures and wrote most of the words, and we put together a book called How to Restore Your Mustang. Did very well for the company. It really was a springboard for Mustang Monthly to keep going back in those days. Well, then Larry had, you know, he was trying to think, what's going to be our next book? And I don't remember the year. It must have been 81 or 82. I somehow made a connection at Ford Photo Media in Dearborn and went up and got into the archives. And I remember it was in the basement of World Headquarters, and they just gave me free rein of the file cabinets. And I'm going
through,
I'm calling, I call Larry and I said, this is wonderful, you know, and Larry said, buy whatever you think, we'll buy it. So
wow.
I don't remember how many photos we bought. It was a ton. And those photos, I came back and we had to wait a few weeks because they had to print them, and we got the photos and we just going through there. And right then it was like, this can be a recognition guide, because here's all the pictures from Ford that documents what the car should look like. Although we had to be careful because there were some prototypes in there. We had to look for that. But
right.
So that became that and pictures that we took ourselves or had on file from Mustang Monthly became the Mustang Recognition Guide.
Very cool.
And California Mustang, I understand, they bought it from us years ago, and they just reprinted it. They went back in and had the pictures cleaned up and the negatives cleaned up and just did a fantastic job of reissuing the book.
Isn't it amazing what they can do with digital technology now?
Yes, it is.
Speaking of that, obviously when you started photographing for tech stories and for cars, you were using film. And you've been doing this continuously, and the transition from film to digital has happened. I was speaking with Robert McGaffin. I'm sure you know Robert.
Yeah.
He freelances for a lot of books, and his home digs are popular hot rodding. And I had the distinct pleasure of having him shoot a feature on my little Mustang coupe. I really enjoy his company, and I'm in awe of his skill. He's a wonderful photographer. I want your opinion on whether you liked film better or whether you like digital better.
Well, I'm a big fan of digital. You know, I love it because you can take the picture and right there on the screen on the back of your camera, you can pretty much see if you got the shot you wanted, or you mm-hmm. need to overexpose it or underexpose it or whatever you need to do. The thing about, and I enjoyed working with film. I used to have a dark room in our spare bedroom, our spare bathroom, that I used to process black and white negatives and prints. That's how I got started.
Wow.
so that was a neat process to see it all, you know, in the tray there, to see the print come to life. So that was
neat,
and I kind of missed that, but I don't miss the hassles that we had to go through of not getting the right shot, or it was overexposed or underexposed, or you didn't see that shadow, or Kodachrome printed too blue, or any of that. Now you can just fix it in Photoshop, you know.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of people that are listening that don't realize how much work went into a text story with 26 photos. Just do a snapshot. Well, pardon the pun, but just give people an example of what it would take to from framing the shot to having it developed and ready for print into the magazine. What was that process on just one single photo?
Well, you would take the photo. In fact, you would take several of them because you wanted to make sure you had the right exposure. You might overexpose or underexpose. And of course, then it was on film in your camera. And well, if you did it yourself, like I did, you have to go in the dark room, take the film out, put it in the little roly things there, and put it in the developer for the right amount of time, and pull it out and let it dry. Then you had to pick the negatives and put them into an enlarger, and expose the light onto the onto the print, and then you know, you would put it in the developer, and then I believe it was called a fix, and then you rinse it, and so that was just to get the print. Well, to get from there to get it onto the printed page, you had to go through, and I think this was called a stat camera. We actually had one at Mustang Monthly where it was rephotographed with the little dots. You know, if you look at real close at a picture on a printed page, you'll see that it's made up of little dots.
Yeah, it's called a dot matrix, isn't it?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure what that was called. But that,
I might be making that up. I don't know.
That would wouldn't be the first time for you, Kevin. But
no. I can BS with the best of them.
But that would give you the dots, so that it would come out on the printed page. So. And you could blow it up or make it larger, smaller, so it would, or to make it fit. And you had to, I remember the art directors had to mark them up. They would say, you know, 79%, and to get the percentage right so it would fit in the space they had allotted on the page, and paste up with, you know, glue and all that, so, and Sacto knives and. Yeah, there was a lot. Now we just do it right there on computer screens.
And I was going to quote Betty White talking about Facebook. It sounds like a colossal waste of time.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I'm just glad we didn't have to set type, you know.
We
had typesetters where somebody just typed it in and it came out as already typed.
Yeah.
Back in the old days when they had to actually make the type and lay them out together, and I'm glad we didn't have to do that.
But that's just what it took back then, and that's what everybody did, is what was the industry standard. And thank goodness it was guys that were that dedicated, that were as dedicated as you guys. I don't know. I mean, some of the people that like Gray Baskerville, guys like him that they lived it. And you know, I'm forgetting half the people that I should be reciting right now. But you know, we all grew up with tangible car magazines. I've still got some of the issues. I'd love to show them to you sometime, that were my dad's when he was a teenager.
Yeah.
Car magazines, old Car Craft and custom Rodder books. Those are what I developed my love of custom cars with when I was a little kid, my brother as well. Fingering through those magazines, feeling the pages, anticipating what's on the next page. And the reason I'm going down this little memory lane trip, Donald, is because I know that you share that. We've never talked about it, but I know that you do, and a lot of other people do. And there's been some smack and some talk about, you know, print is dead and magazines are going away. Well, I beg to differ, and I think the people that say that forgot to tell the people that actually buy the magazines, because in my mind, the newsstands are just about as full now as they were, you know, maybe even before this digital revolution came around. The titles come and go, but I wanted to ask you pointedly, what's your opinion? Is the paper magazine on its way out?
I don't think so. You know, our company, Source Interlink Media, has really adopted a kind of a content platform where, you know, I write a story now where 15 years ago it would just go into print. Now it goes into print. It goes on the website. It gets out there for iPads. It goes on iPhones and a whole lot of different. So people can – the content's the same. You just – it's just a different way of delivering it. So I know I love the Internet. Boy, I could sit there at my desk and try to trying to think of some piece of information about a Mustang or whatever, and I can look it up right away. And
oh, it's a fantastic resource.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, I like print. I sit at the office all day and stare at a computer. I don't really want to do it when I come home. So I prefer to that entertainment or information. I like to get it from a magazine or a book.
Yeah, I just think there's a place for both.
I agree.
It's a wonderful resource, but just like actually driving a car. I think the tactile sensation of flipping through a magazine, personally, I hope it's with us for a long, long time. And I don't know. It's just for me, maybe I'm just at that age to where there's a nostalgic tinge to my affinity for it as well.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I remember working at my dad's feed store. A lot of times it was pretty boring there when weren't customers or we didn't have to go offload 8 tons of feed. So I would run up to the local newsstand and look at the car magazines and would often buy them and bring them back and read them there at the feed store. So my first exposure to car magazines was through magazines, through those magazines. Hot Rod Car Craft.
And I read them still to this day, back to back, front to back, cover to cover, and I keep them. I've got it drives my wife crazy because I would get these stacks of magazines, but they're archives. They're information that I can refer back to, and I don't want to let them go. So I like to keep them.
Hang on to them. I lucked out.
Yep.
I didn't keep the ones that I had bought, but I lucked out. A friend of mine had a collection that somebody had given him, and he was cleaning out his garage, and he told me to come get them. So I still have those. I mean, sports
Very
car
cool.
graphic, and in fact, I'm looking at some of them now. Speed and Supercar, Road Test. I mean, just some fantastic resources for me and my job today.
Did you stumble across one of those Boss 302 books that goes for $200-$300 on eBay?
No, but I did. I did keep a couple of those.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. Isn't it kind of cool to be considered a collector's item? Because you are that book.
Yeah, it is. I didn't know what was ever going to come of it. You know, we sold it to California Mustang along with Recognition Guide and How to Restore Your Mustang. And I think it was such a small market, they decided not to reprint it when they ran out of books. So it was out of print for so many years. And so people who wanted a copy, eBay came along, and next thing you know, I'm watching them sell for $400 or $500 on eBay, and I'm going, why didn't I keep several boxes?
Yeah, no kidding.
I have
no
two.
No kidding.
But I really lucked out. I started hearing rumors that Ford might come back out with a new Boss 302 for the 12 model year. So it was in the back of my mind that if that happened, maybe I would redo the book myself. California Mustang was kind enough to revert the rights to the content of the book back to me. And,
very nice.
And so that was in the back of my mind. And then must have been 2011, I was up in Detroit and had contacted a good friend of mine, John Clore, who does the Ford Enthusiast Group. At Ford Racing, and he said, "I'm glad you called. When you come up here, can we meet for lunch?" And so we arranged to do that. So as soon as I got off the plane, got the rental car, picked up John, went to lunch, and he said, "I'm gonna tell you something, but you got to promise me you won't say a word." He said, "I've got a proposal for you, and it involves something you can't talk about." And so, okay, and. He told me that Ford was indeed going to come out with a 12 Boss 302, and that's what I couldn't say anything about.
Right.
And because he was an insider, they had approached him about writing the book. He worked at Auto Week. He's done a lot of writing. And when they told him that they wanted to include the history of the Bosch 302, at that point he said he just kind of threw up his hands and said, there's no way he could redo my old Bosch 302 book. So he recommended that I do the book and add the new car to it. And,
Well, as a continuation of the original?
Yes. In fact, the new book is pretty much the 69 to 70 part is pretty much my old book, but just added information from what we've learned over the past years. And added the new car to it.
That's great. We're talking with Donald Farr, editor of Mustang Monthly and author of many fine Ford branded books. I'm going to call you a historian, my friend. It's just really cool to be able to talk with you. And we're speaking of Mustangs, and Mustang is coming up on its 50th anniversary. And for me, that's hard to believe because I can still remember looking out at this 65 Mustang coupe that my dad had. It was this orange car, and it was probably a POS, but I loved that car, and it's just ingrained in my brain. I wanted to ask you what you think about the progression of Mustang over the years. We all have our favorites, and Mustang has certainly gone through its transitions and changes. But let's talk about the lean years into the 70s and the Mustang II. First of all, let me backtrack. What is your favorite? Do you have a favorite Mustang?
I would probably still have to say the 70 Bosch 302 is my favorite. Mm-hmm. But, this 13 Shelby GT500 is one fantastic car. I was up at the press preview last year, 662 horsepower, 1,800 RPMs, loafing along at 80 miles an hour. It's a fabulous car. It's probably the best Mustang they've ever built.
Wow. Now, we almost lost the Mustang. It almost turned into the Ford Probe. So just do a snapshot story. Educate some of our listeners as to why that never happened and why it became the Probe and why we actually ended up with a rear-wheel drive Mustang again.
Well, John Coletti, who headed up the 94 Mustang program, kind of gave the credit to Mustang Monthly. I think there was a lot more than that, but we'll take it.
Absolutely.
You know, we got wind. It had to be it was the late 80s that Ford was looking to discontinue the rear-wheel drive Mustang, turn it into a front-wheel drive car. And, of course, we, along with pretty much the whole Mustang hobby universe, kind of disagreed with that thinking.
I think that's a kind way of putting
it. So that happened to be when I was back at one of my stints at Mustang Monthly, and I don't think it was anything other than I had to write an editorial, and I said, well, what can I write about this month? And I said, well, that maybe I should write something about Ford shouldn't do this. And so I did, and I included the address for Donald Peterson, Ford president, Ford World Headquarters, Dearborn, and suggested that readers write in. And
very good.
I've heard some numbers that 30,000 letters showed up at Ford World Headquarters. And then maybe, again, I can't prove any of this, but I heard through the grapevine that kind of got them thinking maybe we should take another look at this. And they went to John Coletti and said, would you like an opportunity to save the Mustang? And he said yes. And he spearheaded a Skunk Works group that developed the 94 Mustang based on a modified Fox body chassis because they didn't have a whole lot of money for development. And the 94 Mustang, a great retro look, and and off we went. The Mustang survives to this day. To my knowledge, the only American car, maybe the only international car that has been produced every year for 50 years.
And Mr. Coletti, of course, went on to spearhead the SVT program and bring us things like, oh, the Lightning,
yeah,
and, you know, the Terminator Mustangs, and great, great program from Ford, and it has endeared me to Ford. I love Ford anyways. I love them all, but I always gravitate towards Fords, and it just makes me – it just gives me a warm spot, you know, way down deep inside, because they never forgot, and they never forgot the passion and the need for a rear drive, a front engine platform, and how important that is for, you know, arguably for Americana.
Yeah, well, I was another great thing that happened to me in the past year was Ford asked me to write the 50th anniversary Mustang book. Mustang 50 years is the name of it. And and going back and looking at the Mustang across these 50 years, how it progressed, how it changed, it's still very much the same car that Lee Iacocca envisioned back in the early 60s, which was a compact car. I mean, the first Mustang was based on the Falcon. All they did was rebody it and make it look more sporty. But it was basically a sporty four-seat car with a trunk that a family could go out in, or a secretary could drive to work with the six-cylinder. Carroll Shelby could turn it into a GT350 and a race car that won championships. So it was so many things to so many people, and it's still that way today.
One of the most interesting conversations, not a conversation, but lectures that I've been a part of, was up at one of the Carlisle shows. And I think you guys were up there as well, but Mr. Bill Shank was giving a lecture or a workshop or a seminar, whatever you want to call, and talking about his experience, which is vast as a designer with Ford, and just really interesting stuff. And the thing that comes to mind when you and I are talking right now is the design changes that came about just from gearhead car guys thinking. For instance, when they were looking for a little bit better fuel economy, a little bit better aero on these cars, some guys figured out that the LTD composite headlights would fit without a whole lot of work into the Fox body fascia and would streamline the front end of the car. And it seems like there was something really bad going to happen if they didn't pull a few more miles per gallon out of that platform. And that's one of the things that did
it. That was another one of those little lucky things that happened to the Mustang. They were working on the Fox body Mustang for 79, and it looked very much like a Fairmont. It was boxy. Well, they hired Jack Telnak, who had been running Ford European operations, and brought him back to the States. And he brought that European look, aerodynamics, and feel, and he kind of started over from scratch on the 79 Mustang. And that's where the aerodynamics and the laid-back grille came from. That was a time when we needed fuel mileage. And you mentioned the Mustang, too, and my thoughts on the Mustang, too, are it was the right car for the right time. A stroke of luck. I won't say genius, although, you know, Iacocca maybe he was. But as early as 68, people were complaining that the Mustang was getting too big. And by 69, I think Ford was already looking to downsize the Mustang back to its original dimensions and had no idea that the oil embargo was going to happen, fuel prices were going to go up, people were going to be waiting in line. The Mustang II came out in the fall of 73, and by the first of 74, people were waiting in lines to get gas and paying high prices, and they traded in their muscle car Mustangs and went out and bought a Mustang II.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the 74 Mustang II is the fourth highest-selling Mustang in history.
And they still get a bad rap. You know, I like the cars. The styling is bang on. They're really sexy cars. They've got hips. They've got, you know, all the design cues borrowed from past Mustangs are there. And, you know, who didn't have a crush on Farrah Fawcett as well?
Yeah,
so how could you not like Mustang too? But I don't know. It seems like they get kind of historically ignored, and I kind of feel bad about that because I like the cars.
Yeah,
but,
they get a bad rap
just one of those.
They really didn't have any performance. I mean, you think about a 74, it was the only year that the Mustang didn't have a V8. Clifton, mm-hmm. they came back out with a 302, but it was a two barrel, and it was a good car, a good engine for the time. But you know, people who remembered 428 Cobra Jets and 289 high performance cars just didn't warm up. So the Mustang enthusiast did not warm up to the Mustang II.
Right, but the general buying public loved it, obviously.
I'd have to count it up. They may have sold a million of them, but not close to it.
Well, you've rubbed shoulders with people that are not only iconic with Ford and with Mustang, but in the automotive industry as well, and racing. I know you've been in the same room as Carroll Shelby, and I know we were both sad when the news came that he had passed. Was he as gregarious and interesting as all the stories that we're led to believe tell? Was he the kind of crazy Texan that everybody said he was?
Well, I didn't get to see a lot of that, but I do remember the first time that I spent any amount of time with Carroll, and that was about 6 or 7 years ago when I was asked to put together an annual magazine for Shelby. It was Shelby Automobiles at the time, but that Shelby American now. And so to go out to Las Vegas and to visit with them to gather photos and information, photographer Jerry Heasley and I went out, and they arranged for Carroll to be there at the same time so we could do a cover shoot with Carroll, and I could mm-hmm. also interview Carroll. So, you know, we did our interview. And he was always great with the press. He's just a wonderful interview. And mm-hmm. so after that, we kind of hung out. He was at Shelby Automobiles, and there were some things that he needed to do. He signed a ton of autographs for his foundation. And so he wanted to go down to the speed shop and check out what was going on down there. So I just went around with him, and he just told these stories. And I remember the one that he talked about. He went on a cruise one time, and he didn't say when. It had to be after kind of the heyday of the 60s. And he and Zora Arcus Duncoff ended up on the same cruise ship together. Here's the father of the Corvette and the father of the Cobra. And he said they had the most wonderful time. They would go into one of the lounge areas, sit in the back corner, and talk about the old days. And what I would have loved to have had a recorder that I could have just stuck in there.
Oh, man. No kidding.
Those two.
What a I in my tenure with television, I've been able to be in the same room of some of my idols and meet people that I would never have access to, and I'm humbled by that.
Yeah.
And I so appreciate it. And in some conversations with Vic Edelbrock Jr., he would tell stories about people like Carroll Shelby, and we had it was a 427 Cobra that Dean Jeffries had painted pearl white, and it was actually in the muscle car studio at RTM, and it was me and a couple of other knuckleheads and Vic Edelbrock, and just standing there with the hair standing up on my arms while he's telling stories about Carroll Shelby and back in the day, and you know, you don't ever want to like spy or eavesdrop on somebody, but I kind of had the same thought is man, I wish I could press a button and record this conversation, if for no other reason, just to listen back to it sometime. And I don't know. It seems like so many of those moments are lost forever, and it's kind of sad. Actually,
one of the interviews that I really wanted to do, and we could never pull it off because of scheduling, and then of course Carroll passed away, and we had kind of started talking to Carroll's people and Lee Iacocca's people. We wanted, and they lived near each other. In Beverly Hills area, they had houses close to each other, so
yeah.
We thought we could pull it off. I wanted to get Lee Iacocca and Carroll Shelby together for an interview, but
wouldn't that be?
Yeah, just to have Lee talk about the first time Carroll came in and wanted to buy engines for his little Cobra.
Uh-huh.
To hear those stories from their own mouths. Yeah, I understand Lee said somebody give him the money before he bites somebody. So, yeah, I'm really disappointed that, we weren't able to pull that one off. But, we still have a few of those people out there and trying to get some of their thoughts and memories down, recorded or on the in the magazine is something we're working on.
Well, the legacy is not gone, and certainly the future of Shelby is in really great hands with some of the people down there in Las Vegas. I wanted to ask you, the future of the Mustang, we've seen these crazy sketches and prototype drawings and renderings of what's coming down the pike. For people that don't know, what's the next year and what's the next big pivotal change for the Mustang as far as a body style goes from the current S197?
Well, that's going to happen next year as a 2015 mm-hmm. model. I'm understanding that they're going to reveal what it's going to look like and the features sometime early next year and possibly go on sale August of 2014. It all kind of ties into the 50th anniversary of the Mustang. I'm hearing just like everybody else, you know, I'm hearing different things. I'm pretty sure it's going to have IRS, won't have the solid rear axle like Mustangs have always had, mm-hmm. except for the Cobra for a few years. And it's thinking it's going to be downsized a little bit, but they keep telling me that it's going to have something of every Mustang generation before it in the car, so...
Well, I think it's great that they're carrying the retro styling in and doing it in a way to where it's reminiscent, but it's still fresh.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping for with the 2015.
Well, one thing that's for sure, I mean, you've driven the Super Snakes, and we're talking about 1,000 horsepower Shelby cars, and heck, my little 66 coupe with the Terminator engine in it, it's pushing 600 horse at the flywheel.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous, the potential. And, you know, downsize, less cylinders, doesn't matter. The EcoBoost platform, there's really exciting things coming down the pike, and not only just because it's cool and it's high performance, but because it's increased efficiency, and you can have your cake and eat it too. And that's one of the things that makes me feel really good about the automotive aftermarket, about the future of Mustang, of Camaro. What's your thought on what's coming in the next 10 years, Donald?
Boy, that's really hard to say. You know, the fuel mileage standards is really going to press the manufacturers to continue what they've been doing. Never imagined they would get 662 horsepower from a relatively small displacement V8 and still get 20-something mm-hmm. miles to the gallon and very little emissions. So they're just going to have to continue pushing that progress. So I don't know. You know, who knows what's going to happen? I'm sure I know a lot of people really don't like the fuel economy standards, but really that just forces the manufacturers to search out new technology, which is giving us fuel mileage and performance.
And speaking of new technology, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, we all turned our noses up at hybrids. And, you know, if you watch Le Mans, there's hybrid Audis that are just absolutely brutally fast, unbelievably well-engineered automobiles and race cars. So hybrid is not a dirty word anymore. Mixed technology is not, you know, there's other things as well, alternative fuels. So, you know, the only thing constant is change.
Yeah.
And that's been a fact ever since there have been facts. So I don't know. Maybe I'm the eternal optimist, but I believe that our hobby, high performance, automotive aftermarket, I don't think it's going to get squashed by these EPA mandates and the fuel economy stuff. I think it's just going to force people into a little bit tighter constraints, if you will. But I think it will breed more invention. I think it'll breed technology.
Yeah, it has, and I think it will down the road. The only thing about hybrids, we've got to figure out a way to make them make some good noises.
Exactly. See, that's
a little word doesn't quite get it, like, you know, a 428 with open exhaust.
No, that's exactly it. Well, listen, what is coming up for you? Are you going to continue, you know, you're probably not allowed to talk about it, but are you going to continue as the editor for Mustang Monthly? I certainly hope so. But what else is in Donald Farr's plans in the future?
Well, I hope they keep letting me do this. Yeah, that's certainly something that I would like to keep doing. It's what I know. It's what I enjoy. You know, I'm not a kid anymore, so I like the predictability of the magazine and all that. Of course, we got the 50th anniversary coming up, and as you're probably aware, that's less than a year from now, April 17th, 2014. The Mustang Club of America, with Ford sponsorship, is going to have two events: one in Charlotte, one in Las Vegas at the speedways. It's going to be a big celebration. I've been looking forward to this for 10 years, since the 40th anniversary, to see what comes to pass at the 50th anniversary. I know Ford has a lot of things in store. We haven't heard what they are yet, but I think we're going to see some really new special cars come out of the woodwork. We already are. Some really special cars are being restored for this. The first two Shelby Mustangs are being restored as we speak.
Oh, wow.
The debut at the 50th anniversary. So that, and the 2015 Mustang, and just all the hoopla that's going to surround 50 years of this wonderful car is just going to be phenomenal. And I've got to cover it all. I've got to figure out how to cover it all.
I believe you'll get there.
Plus, I've got a 50th anniversary book coming out. So, you know.
Well, yeah, there you go. So there's no grass growing between
right,
your toes,
right.
I'm sure.
It's going to be a busy year or year and a half.
Well, for people that are listening, how would they find out, other than, of course, subscribe to Mustang Monthly, how would they find out about these celebrations and the shows in Las Vegas and the things that we can attend to also celebrate Mustang's 50 years?
Well, you definitely find out about the celebrations at the Mustang Club of America website, which is www.mustang.org. They have and you can link to the. I believe they're calling it. It's kind of long, but the Mustang 50th birthday celebration. So that's a lot to type in. .com.
Right.
So we just go to mustang.org and look for the link to the events, and they have information about both Las Vegas and Charlotte.
Very cool. Well, I hope to, at the very least, be there, but in some form or fashion, I hope to be a part of that somehow. I've been a Mustang freak and a diehard, you know, fan, and I've restored them. With your help and with some other people's help, I've been able to consider myself kind of a hackneyed automotive journalist and write text stories on Mustangs.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I'm excited about it. And, you know, I wanted to say also, Donald, that you, Jim Smart, Jeff Ford, Miles and Wayne Cook, you guys, it was a long time ago. And I was this idiot that said, you know, how can I start doing this stuff? And, you know, I just wanted to learn about it. I wanted to learn about writing text stories and sharing that information. As you know, with my patrication business, I'm very, very passionate about passing on these skills to people that not only want to learn, but have the same drive that we all do about sharing this information. And you guys were very kind to me, and you always gave me the time, and you always answered my emails or phone calls, and allowed me to kind of hang on your coattails and learn a little bit about, and you gave me opportunities through the years, and I just wanted to say out loud and publicly that I really, really appreciate that, Donald, and you didn't have to, but you did, and I want to thank you.
Well, you know, we could see in you the passion for the cars, and a lot of times that's what it takes to be good at whatever you want to do, is to have the passion and the love to put in the time and energy to make yourself good at what you do. And we saw that in you, at least I did, and proud of what you've accomplished, and now I see you on TV and radio shows and websites, and you don't have time to write stories for us anymore. So
Well, I don't know. Hopefully, I will find a way to make 28 or 29 hours in a day sometime soon. But it's kind of like what you were talking about with Mr. Dobbs way back. And you know, when doors open, sometimes you got to sprint through them, not just walk through them. And I've been blessed and fortunate in my time to have some doors open for me. And you know, there's a saying that I love quotes. The harder I work, the luckier I get. And that applies to so many people that I know, and I say that with a smile on my face. It's not something that I've done by myself. I've had the fortune of knowing guys like you and other people that have taken me under their wing. So it's a cool thing to be a part of and do what I'm doing, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Yeah, well, that's great when you know you can go to work every day and you know you're going to enjoy it. And somebody pays you to do it.
And I owe you a ride in my Mustang.
Yes, you do. I've seen pictures of it.
It is a visceral experience, even standing beside that silly thing. The exhaust is about 18 inches long from the header collector's back, and it dumps ahead of the rear axle. The Magnaflow mufflers on it are the 4-inch round. If you put a lens on one end, it would be a telescope. So there's not a whole lot of noise baffling except at idle. But it's a fun little car, and I can't wait to take you for a spin. I'll even toss you the keys. Well, actually, there is no key. It's a key fob proximity thing with a touch. It's got that ISIS electronic system in it.
There's that technology stuff again.
I know. It's crazy. It's big time fun. So we'll make that happen too. But I wanted to say thanks on my behalf and everybody listening for doing what you do for the Mustang hobby. And I'm just so looking forward to turning the next page, Donald. Thank you
so
much.
Thank you, Kevin.
Donald Farr is an interesting guy, and yes, he's as nice as he seems like he would be, certainly humble about his accomplishments. It's pretty refreshing to be able to talk so comfortably with someone that has broken bread with icons in the publishing industry, as well as in the automotive world. I hope you enjoyed it today. So thanks for taking the time to listen to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates, and until next time, thanks to the Eastwood Company, and thanks for listening. In the meantime, check out everything at the Eastwood.com website. Eastwood has what it takes to do the job right. And you know me, I like to do the job right. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk. I'm Kevin Tates.